Thank you, Tim. I greatly appreciate it. I'm happy to be here this morning and to share with you all. So without further ado, let's progress these slides to the point where we're going to get started here. So the first question on everyone's mind is, how might the court rule in these important cases? The first thing to note at the outset is that there are two questions before the court, and while the questions are related, I'll specifically highlight those at the outset because I will refer to that distinction throughout this morning. So the two questions are what I call the licensing question and the recognition question. The licensing question is, must a state license a same-sex relationship as a marriage within its borders? And then the second question, which I refer to as the recognition question, is, must a state recognize a same-sex marriage created in another state? So those are the two questions before the court. And again, while they are related, there are some distinctions. So what I'd like to highlight very briefly are the two most likely outcomes, two less likely outcomes, and then just point out that there are, frankly, myriad outcomes, and just highlight a few other very, very unlikely outcomes, something that we could see the court do. When a court faces such a massive issue like the one before it, there are so many different ways that the court can go that it's really hard to pin down exactly what the court will do. But I will start, as I said before, with the two most likely outcomes. So those are a win on both questions. And that would essentially affirm that a state may continue to define and understand marriage in the law as the union of a man and a woman. So that they need not either license same-sex relationships as a marriage, and that they need not recognize such a marriage created in another jurisdiction. So that is the first potential outcome. The second potential most likely outcome would be a loss on the first question. And if there's a loss on the first question, and the court says that a state must license a same-sex relationship as a marriage, then there's no need to decide the second question. The implications of a loss on the first question is essentially that there would be same-sex marriage in all 50 states, and the marriage would be redefined across the nation. So those are the two most likely outcomes, and as we go through this morning, those are the two that I'll really focus on. But now let me talk about, very briefly, two other less likely outcomes that are at least worth mentioning. Those would be what I call a win on the first question and a bad loss on the second question. So let me explain what I mean by that. A win on the first question would be, a state doesn't need to license a same-sex relationship as a marriage, but a state must recognize all same-sex marriages created in another state. Now, effectively, what that would do is to bring about a 50-state same-sex marriage mandate throughout the country, but it would do so indirectly because, as we know, there are a number of states out there that have already redefine marriage. There are about 11 of them that have done so through democratic means, either through the legislature in their state voting or through the people. Only two or three states have done it through the people directly. But all that to say, there would still be some states that would have this redefined understanding of marriage. So all it would take is any same-sex couple interested in taking advantage of that to go to one of those jurisdictions, to come back home, and then to tell their state, you must now recognize my marriage. So the actual effect of that sort of a ruling would be pretty much to bring a redefined understanding of marriage nationwide, even though it would do so in sort of an indirect way. And then the last of the options that I'll specifically talk about here today would be a win on the first question and what I call a narrow loss on the second question. And what that would look like is that the court would say that states can decline to license same-sex marriages in their own state, but they must recognize same-sex marriages from other states unless they decline to recognize not only same-sex marriages, but all other marriages that conflict with their public policy on marriage. So, and what I mean by that is, you know, some states will allow first cousins to marry, and some states will not allow that. So if a state is going to decline to recognize a same-sex marriage from another jurisdiction, then it needs to also consistently decline to recognize all the other sorts of unions that another state might grant a marriage license for that state necessarily wouldn't. So I won't dive into all the details of that because it gets pretty much convoluted and confusing, and I don't think it's helpful. But I just want everyone to know that there are a lot of different outcomes that are potentially on the table, and that is one of them. Another thing that the court can do is, some of you might be aware that one of the primary arguments against these marriage laws is that they are motivated by so-called animus, so-called hatred or ill will against same-sex couples. So if the court were to agree with that argument, it could potentially strike down some of the marriage, the constitutional amendments that states have enacted defining marriage as the union of a man and a woman. It could strike those down and say, well, those are illegitimate because they're motivated by what the courts have referred to as animus, but that this underlying marriage definition between a man and a woman that has existed for millennia, well, that's okay. You just can't have this constitutional amendment that affirms that in your law. But you can continue to have that in your law. You just can't have it in your constitutional amendment because that was impermissibly motivated by considerations that can't motivate laws. And so that's just one example of the potential, again, unlimited options of what's available to the court because the case is so complex. But moving on, the real question in everyone's mind is, well, what might the court do? In other words, you've laid out some options there, but what really might the court do in the end? And I think anyone who's at least a somewhat informed follower of the Supreme Court knows that Justice Kennedy is a very critical member of the court in cases like this that tend to fall right within sort of culture war issues and very hotly contested social issues because he does tend to sit in the center of the bench from a judicial philosophy perspective. So on that question, what might Justice Kennedy do? I just wanted to highlight a few things from the oral argument that I think are interesting in trying to read what Justice Kennedy might do in the end. I'll start with a bad indicator that we saw from Justice Kennedy at the oral argument, and that is the attorney who was defending the marriage laws was interrupted by Justice Kennedy, and Justice Kennedy said, "In fairness to you, I don't understand this point you're making that marriage is not about conferring dignity on the couple that gets married. I thought that was the whole purpose of marriage. It bestows dignity on both man and woman in a traditional marriage." Well, that's a bad indicator, of course, because if that is the purpose of marriage, then that doesn't bode well for the ultimate outcome in the case. In other words, the state's position is that marriage exists to bring together a man and a woman in a sexual relationship so that when they have children, it's more likely that those children are going to be raised by the man and the woman that created them, that those kids are going to know and be known by and be raised by both their mom and their dad. If, on the other hand, Justice Kennedy views marriage as simply a government tool to bestow dignity on adult relationships, then it makes it more worrisome that he might decide to extend that state recognition to same-sex relationships. Of course, I'll point out just in passing that if that is the purpose of marriage, then there's no line that can be drawn to stop at same-sex relationships. In other words, if the point is to bestow dignity on adult relationships, and any adult relationship that is excluded can claim, well, we're being denied dignity from the state, well, then any excluded adult relationship can come and demand the same thing and theoretically can extend the definition of marriage even further. So, you know, an example would be a polyamorous relationship involving perhaps three individuals. If they're not getting recognition from the state is something that they can claim denies them of this dignity bestowing tool, then you see that the court would create an unworkable standard. So we're hopeful that Justice Kennedy will not go down that road. But On the other hand, the good indicator is that Justice Kennedy stopped the attorney arguing against the marriage law and said, quote, this definition has been with us for millennia, this man-woman definition, and it's very difficult for the court to say, oh, well, we know better. Moreover, not just Justice Kennedy acknowledged this, but Justice Breyer, who, again, anyone who knows much about the court realizes that Justice Breyer is someone who is traditionally acknowledged as more of a left-leaning member of the court. But he even said at the oral argument that the man-woman definition of marriage, quote, has been the law everywhere for thousands of years among people who were not discriminating against gay people. And suddenly, you want nine people outside of the ballot box to require states that don't want to change what marriage is to include same-sex couples. So he too recognized that there's this, we're dealing with something that has been with us for a long time. So we need to be very, very careful when frankly, messing with it by three unelected judges. So that's a quick discussion of how the court might rule, the various options, what we learned from the oral argument, what we saw. At the end of the day, it's anyone's guess how the court is going to rule in the end, but those are the various options. So the next question we have is, what are the potential ramifications of the court's decision? We'll go through this pretty briefly. We'll start with the win scenario. Under the win scenario, what would be the outcome? What would that mean at the end of the day if the court found that states were free to continue affirming marriage as a union of a man and a woman? Well, first thing it would mean is that states are free to affirm that definition, but states are also free to decide to redefine marriage through the legislative process. So if the legislators go into session and enact a law, or if the people come together and enact a ballot initiative, then they can decide to change the definition of marriage. So what that means for all of us is that even if we get a win, it is still important to continue to talk to our friends, our family, our relatives about the importance of this issue. Because ultimately what the court will be saying is not that all states have to define marriage as the union of a man and a woman, but all states have the freedom to do that should they so choose. So the ongoing discussion in our society will continue about what marriage is, the definition of marriage, the purpose of marriage, and what exactly should be the future of marriage in light of all those considerations. Also, if the court were to rule in favor of the marriage laws, the ultimate outcome would be that there are still 16 states that through various state means, either through the people enacting a law, the legislators enacting a law, or the state courts system interpreting their own law, there are 16 states that would still have this redefined understanding of marriage. But there would be approximately the remaining 34 states that would be able to restore their laws affirming marriage as the union of a man and a woman. So at the end of the day, you would have roughly two-thirds of the states that would continue to affirm man-woman marriage, and you would have approximately a third of the states that would have this redefined understanding. Briefly, what does it mean under a loss? Well, as I hinted at when I broached that issue above, the bottom line is that most of the loss scenarios would result in all 50 states either recognizing or licensing same-sex marriages. So the most likely outcome of a loss is that all 50 states will have same-sex marriage in one form or another. The biggest thing to highlight there is the religious liberty implications of what a decision like that would mean. And many of the justices expressed concerns about what impact redefining marriage through the judicial process will have on religious liberty. So I'll just quickly highlight two examples. Chief Justice Roberts wondered whether a religious school, and this is a quote from him, quote, a religious school that has married housing, will they be required to afford such housing to same-sex couples? And he asked that question during oral argument, and he didn't really get a very satisfactory answer. In addition, and many people have been talking about this in the media, Justice Alito asked the Solicitor General, whether a decision by the court requiring the redefinition of marriage, whether that would risk the tax-exempt status of a university or a college if they continue to affirm marriage as a union of a man and a woman. And the Solicitor General's, which for those of you that don't know, the Solicitor General is one of the chief lawyers for the federal government in our country, and his response was very candid. He said, it is certainly going to be an issue. I don't deny that, Justice Alito. So the administration has made it very clear that the religious liberty implications are stark and are chilling, and we who have been talking about this for years, while we didn't like what we heard, we expected that. And so to hear the honesty from the administration in response to that question just confirmed what we have suspected for at least a decade, if not more. So the final brief topic that we will address this morning is, how will this affect churches, specifically the LCMS? How will this affect pastors, specifically your pastors? And how will this affect people of faith, specifically those in your congregations? So I think the best way to approach this is with a brief introductory point, and then I'll just give you a few examples of things that we would anticipate seeing. The first introductory point is that some of this depends on how the court rules. If the court rules that these marriage laws and this understanding of marriage is irrational or is motivated by so-called animus, then that poses particular problems for religious liberty. Because, as we've seen throughout history, the law, neither the law nor society, is very friendly to those who society regards as irrational or as animus filled. So if that's what the court says in its decision, then that will be essentially a tool that will be used against people of faith for years to come, because they will continue to say your views are irrational. They will continue to say that you really are just motivated by dislike for a certain class of people. So that's one example of why it matters how the court rules. And I could give many more examples, but that's just one illustration to make the point that how the court rationalizes its decision matters at the end of the day for religious liberty and how this will play out in society. So some examples that we might see in terms of if the court mandates the redefinition of marriage, what might be the outcome at the end of the day? We would expect to see, as I mentioned before, as Justice Alito asked and as the Solicitor General acknowledged, there would be issues with tax exemptions. Specifically, Justice Alito asked about schools, universities, Christian universities, Lutheran universities, other universities that operate based on traditional religious principles that affirm marriage as the union of a man and a woman. That issue would almost certainly arise, as the Solicitor General acknowledged. So that's one category of situations we could expect to see. Another situation that we've already seen in jurisdictions that have redefined marriage is an impact on religious adoption and foster agencies. So we've already seen in the District of Columbia and in Massachusetts and in Illinois, where there has been a redefinition of marriage or a recognition of same-sex relationships, we've seen that Catholic charities and other faith-based organizations have been driven out of the foster and adoption agencies. Have been driven out of providing those services for people in the community. And that's something we unfortunately would expect to see more of should the state require, should the court require same-sex marriage nationwide. Another example of what we would anticipate seeing is that religious groups that host marriage ceremonies, there could be issues that arise of whether they're free to decline to host marriage ceremonies that conflict with their faith. one example is a case that I worked on years ago, and there is a religious ministry. It was specifically a Methodist ministry in New Jersey that had a seaside pavilion in which they hosted wedding ceremonies, and they were approached by a same-sex couple who asked them to if they could have their same-sex civil union ceremony there. And the Methodist group, because of their religious principles, declined, but they were then served with a discrimination complaint, and they spent years defending against that, and ultimately they lost. So we would expect to see potentially more cases like that arise. We would also expect to see more cases, and this would be more, how does this affect people of faith? How does this affect folks in your congregations? We would expect to see that those operating their businesses and trying to do so consistent with their religious beliefs on marriage, that they too would face government punishment, government attack, and government retaliation. Tim talked about earlier some of the cases that I work on with a promotional printer where we're defending his freedom to decline to print messages that he disagrees with. But he also mentioned the case where we defended the wedding photographer in New Mexico. We would expect to see more cases like that. We also represent a florist in Washington State who declined to create the floral arrangements for a same-sex marriage, and we would, again, expect to see more cases like that. The last situation that I'll raise briefly is that we've also seen public officials who have religious convictions on marriage, they have also in certain circumstances been forced out of their job. So where they have job duties that relate to marriage, so for instance, maybe a county clerk that issues marriage licenses, or maybe a judge who solemnizes marriages, those people in certain circumstances have already been forced out of their positions where marriage is redefined. So we've seen that in Canada, we've seen it in New York, we've seen it in Massachusetts, and we've seen it in North Carolina. So we would expect, again, to see more of those circumstances arising should the court mandate the redefinition of marriage. And the last point that I will make before I close is just a brief, what should all of us do going forward, win or lose? What is it important for churches, pastors, congregants to do, whether this case is a win or a loss? And what I mean by this is not, what is it important to do legally to protect yourself? What I mean is, we all should work like we should be doing now. We should continue, regardless of what the court does, to restore a proper understanding of marriage and a proper appreciation of marriage in our culture. As I alluded to before, marriage is not government recognition of a loving relationship. Marriage is an arrangement that seeks to connect children with both their mom and their dad by connecting the moms and the dads to each other. We have to educate ourselves on these issues, and then we have to winsomely communicate the truth to the world. And it's important not only to communicate the truth, but also to live it. And I know, you know, many people say this, and it sounds trite, but there's a lot of truth to, you know, the church needs to reflect the truth about marriage, not just in what we say, but in how we live. So all that to say, I'll get off of my soapbox now and close with that point. But I do think that no matter what the court does, there is a truth about marriage, and I believe that all of us have a role to play in sharing that truth with our neighbors, with our friends, with our colleagues, and with those we interact with on a daily basis. So at this point, I think Tim will start taking questions. Well, until we hear from Tim, I can start pulling out some of these questions that have been written in on the chat column here on the side of the PowerPoint presentation. I'm happy to start addressing those at this point. The first question I see here is, who is bringing this argument to the Supreme Court? That's a great question. The background of these cases is that they involve challenges to four state marriage laws, and they are the states of Michigan, Ohio, Kentucky, and Tennessee. So the folks that are bringing the challenges to the laws are organizations like the ACLU, Lambda Legal, and the National Center for Lesbian Rights, a few other similar organizations like those. Those are the groups that are bringing the challenge. On the other hand, the folks defending the marriage laws are essentially attorneys that represent the governments in those four states. So the attorneys representing the government in the state of Michigan and in Ohio and in Kentucky and in Tennessee. So specifically, the attorney who argued in defense of the marriage laws was a guy named John Bursch, who is an attorney in Michigan that was brought on to help defend the Michigan laws. And he was the primary advocate for the marriage laws in these cases before the Supreme Court. The next question we have here is, let's see here, might the court leave same-sex marriage to be decided in the future by public referendum? So yes, the court. I'll just take that part of the question first, because there are a few aspects, it looks like, to that question. Might the court leave same-sex marriage to be decided in the future by public referendum? Yes, in a sense, that is what the win scenario would be. And maybe yes isn't quite the best answer. Sort of is probably the better answer. If the court rules in favor of these marriage laws and says that the Constitution doesn't require states to redefine marriage, then all states will be free to address this issue as they see fit. And many states will do that through a public referendum. In fact, in many states, that's the only way to redefine marriage, because the states have put the man-woman definition of marriage in their state constitution. And in states that have done that, the only way to override the state constitution is with another state constitutional amendment. So in those states, and there are approximately 31 of them that in their own state constitutions they've affirmed marriage as the union of a man and a woman, the only way to undo that definition of marriage is through a public referendum. So yes, I think that if the court were to rule in favor of the states in these cases and were to uphold the challenge marriage laws, then at the end of the day, the most likely this battle would shift primarily to public referendum. The next question that's under that same entry is, if the Supreme Court rules in favor of states' rights to define marriage, will this reduce judicial activism regarding this kind of issue in the future? The answer to that is it will reduce it, but it will not likely be able to eliminate it. And what I mean by that is, it will likely undermine most of the avenues that federal courts could use to redefine marriage. Because if the Supreme Court says, no, the Constitution doesn't require this, the 14th Amendment to the United States Constitution doesn't require this, then at the end of the day, I think that the federal courts have very few ways to try to require a state to redefine marriage. So it pretty much takes, for the most part, this issue out of the federal courts. And but what it does, and so this is why I would say it sort of reduces judicial activism, it would still allow these sorts of lawsuits to be filed in state courts. So you could go into a state court and say that the state's constitution requires the redefinition of marriage. And in states that have not put the man-woman definition of marriage into the state constitution, that sort of a challenge could go forward. So there are about probably between around five states where that's possible. So we would expect to see some lawsuits in states like that. I think Wyoming is the first one that comes to mind, where you could see a state challenge where some group would come in and say, well, the state constitution requires that marriage be redefined. So regardless of what the federal constitution says, regardless of what the U.S. Supreme Court says, we're bringing this claim under the state constitution. And that sort of a challenge could go forward, and the judges in that situation could decide to redefine marriage and to exercise a bit of judicial activism under the state's constitution. So let's see.
Tim, are you hearing me now?
Hey, Tim.
Hey, that's fine. I didn't interrupt you. I love that game, and I think my mic is working, but so I didn't interrupt you. Please continue.
Okay, I will. Tim, you're breaking up just a bit. I can hear you some, but it's a little spotty. So why don't I just keep going down the list here? The next question I see here is, will the members-only wedding policy in various conservative churches hold up in this case? What I interpret that question to mean is, if a church has a policy that they will only marry members, will that be something that could be subject to attack? I think that would be something that would be very likely to hold up against an attack. The situation that we had in New Jersey with the case that I referenced earlier, they did not have a members-only wedding policy. In fact, they viewed the wedding process as an opportunity for outreach. They viewed it as a wedding ministry, as an opportunity for people in the community who maybe don't hold the same views to come in and for them to have a dialogue with people in the community about that and hopefully to reach out to them with the love of Christ in that way. And that was one of the things that ultimately the court used against the ministry in that circumstance. So I do think that sort of a policy would help, and I think it's likely to hold up, but in the end, you never know what a court might do. And I will also mention that I don't think it should be necessary to have a members-only policy. I think you should be able to have sort of an outreach component in a wedding ministry like the folks in New Jersey did. But again, you just need to be careful in how that's set up. So the bottom line is that a members-only wedding policy would certainly provide more protection than a policy that is more outreach focused. It would probably be a good way to put it. The next question here is, should Christians in their vocation as citizens advocate and work for a constitutional convention to overturn any SCOTUS decision for the redefinition of marriage? On that question, it's certainly an option. A constitutional convention, a constitutional amendment to the federal constitution, and let me briefly talk about two various options that you'll probably hear people talk about should the court decide to mandate the redefinition of marriage. There are two ways that the United States Constitution, the federal constitution, can be amended to sort of overturn any decision that the court issues. The one way is what I call a marriage federalism approach, and that's a federal constitutional amendment that would simply say the states are free to define marriage as they see fit, whether that includes the definition of two people of the same sex or whether that includes the definition of a man and a woman. And that would be a way to preserve the state's freedom to decide this question for themselves. On the other hand, the second approach would be a federal constitutional amendment that itself would define marriage as the union of a man and a woman. So those are two options that are available. The marriage federalism option, the first one I mentioned, is a easier political sell. The marriage definition option, one that at the federal level affirms the definition of marriage as a union of a man and a woman, that would be a more difficult political option. But at the end of the day, those are two potential options that people could pursue to overturn a Supreme Court decision mandating same-sex marriage. The next question here is there no pathway for us to get the government out of the marriage business? And I think the brief answer to that is there really isn't, because when we take a step back and look at marriage as a social institution and all that marriage does in the law, there is really no realistic way to change this, because if the government were to try to get out of the marriage business, imagine all the things that would be left up in the air. So one example is marriage is one of the ways that governments and that society determines the parents for a child. When a woman has a child, her husband is presumed to be the child's father. And if you take away marriage and take the government out of marriage, well, then how are we going to determine who's the father of children when they're born? Are we going to have all children when they're born? They're going to have to bring in and have paternity tests for anyone who could be a potential father so that we confirm that. So their marriage plays a vital role in many social ways. And the idea of getting the government out of the marriage business is something that in practical reality doesn't really work. And so it's not something that we support. And furthermore, marriage is such a vital social good that we think it important, wherever possible, for people of faith to continue to engage in that and to continue to communicate the truth about marriage so that we don't withdraw the light from that discussion. Because as I alluded to before, marriage does serve the vital social good of bringing together a man and a woman in a sexual relationship so that when they have children, those children are more likely to know and be raised by their mother and their father. And what we've seen is where marriage falls apart, where marriage breaks down, where marriage disappears, so marriage rates plummet, and those communities experience a lot more difficulty and economic difficulty, absence of fathers, poverty, lots of stuff like that. When you look at the statistics, you see that where marriage is breaking down the most is in the underprivileged communities. And so what we as a society need to do and what the government needs to do is continue to work towards promoting, restoring, and communicating the truth about marriage. While the task is certainly daunting even now and would become more daunting should the Supreme Court redefine marriage, I think it's vital for folks who understand the truth about marriage to be involved in these issues and to help to set aright the way that the government views and the way the government approaches marriage. Because while marriage is a sacrament for people of faith, marriage is also a vital social good, and it brings about human flourishing throughout communities. So for that reason, we as an organization do not at all support the idea of getting the government out of the marriage business. We believe it's important for people of faith, where possible, to work through legitimate political channels to strengthen and support a good, healthy understanding of marriage. The next question here is, do you foresee a time when Christian pastors will no longer be able to serve as agents of the state with regard to marriage? It is certainly a possibility. There's no way around that. In fact, Justice Scalia, during the oral argument, made that very point. And Justice Scalia said, if we mandate this redefinition of marriage and say that the Constitution in fact requires this, then how in the world can Christian pastors and other clergy that affirm marriage as a union of man and a woman, how can they continue to be agents of the state? I think that there are plenty of good arguments to say that that should not happen, that the free exercise of religion protection in the Constitution does not allow the government to essentially drive people of faith out of this particular participation in the body politic, and it doesn't allow them to marginalize people of faith in this way. And specifically, what the government would be saying in those circumstances is that Christian pastors can't do this, but other, an Episcopal pastor, for instance, from a church — I'm not sure that all Episcopal churches would churches would affirm this principle, but I know that there are some of them out there that would. So if there's a pastor from a church like that believes that marriage could include same-sex couples, then they would be given preferential treatment because of their religious beliefs versus other pastors who hold traditional religious beliefs about marriage as the union of man and a woman, and that I think would be unconstitutional to treat those two clergy different, those two groups of pastors differently. So I don't think that should happen. I think the Constitution should protect against that, but do I foresee a time where a state might try to push Christian pastors out of that role as being agents of the state? I do think that we could see that. But that would be something that we at Alliance Defending Freedom would certainly be interested in defending against. Let me see here. I lost my place. The next question here is there any wisdom in a local congregation proactively opting to not perform any marriages, but rather to simply bless man-woman marriages that have already been solemnized by the state? This is a question that I think is probably best addressed with attorneys that represent the LCMS, just because I think that this is an issue that people can vary on based on not only theological beliefs but also views of the law. So I don't have anything that I feel authoritatively speaks to this issue. I think it's probably one best addressed within your congregation. But and specifically, I should say, not just within your congregation, but also if the larger LCMS community has something to say about it, I think that maybe that's something that could be addressed at a broader level too. But in terms of any wisdom in doing that, again, it's just hard to say because it's an interesting confluence of legal issues and theological issues, and I do think that. But the point that I want to emphasize is that attempts to punish churches or ministers for declining to solemnize same-sex marriages, while we anticipate those coming, we do believe that churches and clergy have ample constitutional authority to continue to solemnize marriages, but decline to do the ones that conflict with their beliefs. And whether that's as functioning as an agent of the state or whether that's functioning simply as a person of faith or as a leader of a religious organization. So I guess there might be some wisdom in doing that, but there are so many different factors that need to come into play. I don't know that I feel comfortable advocating one way or another because of the confluence of theological and legal issues. The next question I have here is, aren't we ultimately concerned about our ability to conduct Holy Communion in keeping with our faith and the guidance of God's Word to exclude the openly unrepentant? I certainly think that is one of the foremost concerns that would be on your minds. So I do think that's a question that again is probably for you all to come to a conclusion on from a theological perspective. From a legal perspective, if that is your conclusion, then you can work back from there and say, if this is ultimately what you're concerned with, then these are the ways to best protect yourself. But on the other hand, as I alluded to before, there's the organization, the religious organization in New Jersey that used this wedding ministry as an opportunity for outreach. And so if a group comes to that conclusion and believes that they should be able to solemnize marriages not only of people within their own faith, but of people of other faiths, so long as they will affirm the basic tenets of marriage that organization affirms, then that is an issue that if that's how they want to approach their view of a wedding ministry is more of an outreach thing, then I think that's something that the law should protect. And in the New Jersey case, it didn't, but we do think that the decision there was wrong. So ultimately, that comes down to a theological question, I think. And then once the theological issue is worked out, then it's a question of how do you protect that legally. The next question here is, what was the rationale for ruling against the Methodist Church in the New Jersey case, even when the ruling seems to violate its legal protection of religious freedom? Very good question, and it leads, or I should say it flows nicely from what I was just talking about. Essentially, the rationale was that because they had opened this up and because they had allowed people who didn't necessarily affirm their religious principles on marriage to enter into marriages there on their premises, the court essentially said, you were really acting like a rental facility. You were really acting like a what's called a place of public accommodation, something that's open to the public. Anyone can come. And so they basically said, listen, your policies were so broad that you let too many people come and you were acting illegally and discriminatory by then drawing the line at same-sex couples. So that was essentially the rationale. And again, I think the main principle to drive home is that the closer that if the Methodist organization there in New Jersey were to say, we're only going to marry Methodists, I think that case would have very likely come out differently. There's no way to know for sure, but I think it was the ministry focus, the outreach focus of their wedding program that ultimately caused the court, and very much incorrectly, actually it wasn't a court, it was an administrative agency, but caused the administrative agency to treat them more like a public business instead of a religious organization. Of course, that ignores the fact that churches, religious ministries, and other religious organizations exist in significant part to reach out to the community and to spread the gospel message throughout their locality. So I think it's important to emphasize that while that case came out wrong, one of the reasons why is because of the outreach focus of the ministry and because of the fact that they weren't simply marrying people who shared their religious convictions. The next question here, and let's see, we still have 5 minutes, so I'll try to go quickly to see if we can get through as many of these as possible. The next question is, so the elephant in the room is that those in same-sex relationships who engage in active sexual relations are breaking God's law. Has there ever been an argument based on the health dangers and the life-threatening diseases that result from these actively sexual relationships between same-sex couples? Yes, those arguments were made in what are called amicus briefs filed with the Supreme Court. So those arguments are before the Supreme Court, and no court has ever addressed those arguments, but those arguments have been put forth. The next question here is, Thomas Paine, in his book Common Sense, once said, society defines government, but government doesn't define society. It seems like this trend is a reversal of such logic. Well said. I couldn't have said it better myself. This is an instance of the government through law changing, or I should maybe say organizations trying to use the law and use the government to change an understanding of marriage in a way that will affect society rather than allowing society to shape government and to shape their laws in a way that reflects the understanding of marriage that they embrace. So this is certainly a reversal of Thomas Paine's logic. Okay. Next question here is it possible for the court to craft its decision in such a way that they mandate same-sex marriage yet provide protection for religious liberty? Or is the religious freedom question something that will have to be litigated separately? Very good question. Bottom line is, it is something that will have to be litigated separately. But the court could go out of its way to say things like, and folks who affirm marriage as a union of a man and a woman are well-meaning, they're good-natured people, they're to be respected in society, but nevertheless, for these constitutional reasons, we believe that marriage has to be redefined in this way. The court could do that, and should they do that, that would be very, very helpful in protecting religious liberty going forward. But the court doesn't have to do that. So at the end of the day, the court has the flexibility to interject things like that in its decision, but whether the issue of full protection for religious freedom and in this case involving a pastor who declines to solemnize a marriage, or in this case involving foster adoption agency that will only place kids with a married mother and father. Those issues are going to have to be litigated separately, but the court could interject language that would provide help in those circumstances. The next question here is, what have other religions, i.e. Islam, LDS, etc., what have they done with regard to same-sex marriage? It's my understanding that those two particular religions continue to affirm marriage as the union of a man and a woman. Okay, we only have a few minutes, but I'm close to the end of the question, so let's see if we can finish this out. Next question here is, if the LCMS decided not to solemnize marriages any longer, but rather bless them after they had been solemnized by the state, do you foresee that there would still be forthcoming legal challenges that the synod, through its congregations, would face? Again, that goes to the issue that came up earlier. I think that should that decision be made, again, I don't propose to speak authoritatively on it, but I think that that would decrease the likelihood of a forthcoming legal challenge if that policy change were made. So that's that. And then the last question here, I have a minute left, so we'll finish with this one. If a congregation determines that they only perform Christian weddings defined as one man and one woman, does this provide protection even if some non-members are being married? Yes, I think that would provide more protection. Again, I think maybe the best way to illustrate this is there would be a spectrum of protection. The furthest side of protection is only marry members, then you still have significant protection, but a little bit less so under this scenario where only perform Christian weddings defined as one man and one woman, and then as you continue to open up the policy more and permit more people who aren't members or don't share the same religious convictions, that the more the doors open, the more it's cracked for legal challenges as well. So I think that about does it. I'm not sure if Barb or Tim want to chime in and wrap it up.
I appreciate your rapid-fire, thorough, complete addressing of all these questions and your great answers. Again, this webinar is recorded and will be posted to our website on lcms.org, free to be faithful, and we will... on that website, we'll have all sorts of different resources that will be made available that you can sink into and learn more. Also, the Alliance Defending Freedom.org website.